start, I would just like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk and also for organizing what has so far been a very enjoyable meeting. So what I will talk about today is constrained quantum dynamics and some work that I've done with Roger Brodie and Lane Houston at Imperial College in London. And more specifically, what I will review is two different but complementary frameworks for looking at constraints in quantum mechanics. So the scenario that we have is the following. Say that we wish to implement unitary motion of our quantum system, but the system is subject to some set of constraints. The question then is, how does one in general formulate a theory of quantum mechanics where you can have constrained motion? So in classical physics, there is a framework for doing this due to Dirac from the 1950s, where he formulated a theory of constraints on the classical phase space, which is a symplectic manifold. So one of the first things one might ask is there an analog of the classical phase space description for quantum mechanics? And as was touched on earlier in the question to Philip, there is indeed such a description, which is sometimes referred to as geometric quantum mechanics, which was developed by many people, among whom can you mention Kibble, Marsden, Weinberg, in the 70s and the 80s. So what I will do is I will start by giving a brief overview of this description, and then I will describe these two different frameworks for implementing constraints. And the first framework is basically taking the methodology developed by Dirac and applying it to this quantum phase space to get a framework for treating constraints. But this has some limitations. For instance, you can only do it when you have a system that is subject to an even number of constraints. So while working on this, we realized that there is a different way that you can do it for quantum systems that doesn't have a classical analog, but which uses a similar approach that allows you to treat a slightly larger class of constraints. And then I will wrap up by giving a very, very brief description of how one might then, because what I should mention is that this state space that we're working on is the state space of pure quantum states. So I will wrap up by just briefly discussing a little bit how one might go about treating mixed states in this sort of constrained framework. So as John mentioned yesterday in his introduction to quantum information, the expectation value of an observable in quantum mechanics is independent of the norm of the state vector in Hilbert space. So in other words, we can make this identification and choose to, instead of working in Hilbert space, work in the space of rays through the origin of Hilbert space, and we will basically end up with the same physics. And this basically just corresponds to projective Hilbert space. And projective Hilbert space we can view in real terms as an even dimensional manifold, which I call gamma. And gamma is equipped with a Riemannian structure given by the Fibini-Studi metric, and also a compatible symplectic structure. And this is really the phase space analog of the classical phase space, but for quantum mechanics. Physical observables in this language is given by function. So for example, for the Hamiltonian operator, we get the Hamiltonian function, which is given by the expectation value of the Hamiltonian operator at each point in our manifold. The eigenstates of this operator corresponds to the fixed points of this flow. So in other words, they lie at the points where this relation holds true. And the eigenvalues are just given by the value of this function at these points. And the phase space formulation of the Schrödinger equation in this language is the following, where xa just denotes our coordinates in phase space. This is the inverse of the symplectic structure, and this is again our Hamiltonian function. And somewhat remarkably, we see that this has exactly the form of Hamilton's equation for classical mechanics, only now the phase space is the quantum mechanical phase space and not the classical phase space. We can say that the Schrödinger equation corresponds to classical Hamiltonian evolution on the symplectic manifold defined by the quantum phase space. And this is quite a remarkable fact that didn't seem to be appreciated for some time. So not everyone perhaps is comfortable with this formulation of Hamilton's equation. So what we can do is we can define, we can make a choice of our canonically conjugate coordinates such that this becomes more obvious. And I basically do this by defining them in terms of the expansion coefficient of a state in energy basis in the following way. Expanding the Hamiltonian operator in energy basis and then taking the expectation value that gives me the Hamiltonian function in these coordinates, which is just this relation here. And then we find that the equations of motion that I had on the previous slide in terms of these coordinates just gives us the familiar form of Hamilton's equation that everyone should recognize from classical mechanics. And substituting the Hamiltonian function into here, we find that it has the following solutions. So going back to constrained system, so the idea that Dirac's method for classical systems might be applicable to quantum systems by applying it on this quantum phase space was first suggested by Burich last year, who used it to look at a very particular example of a quantum system. Similar idea has been put forward by Carici in a somewhat different context. And so we decided to think, is there some way that we can formulate this for a general set of constraints, not necessarily restricted to any particular examples? However, we found, as I said earlier, that this has some limitations in what kind of set of constraints you can use it for. For instance, one of the requirements is that it has to be an even number of constraints. So we also realized that there was an alternative way of doing it. So just in order to establish terminology that I will be using throughout the rest of the talk, when I will be talking about extending Dirac's work onto the quantum phase space, I will be talking about the symplectic approach, given its name by the fact that it uses the symplectic features of the underlying geometry. And the new approach relies on the fact that on our quantum phase space, we also have a metric geometry, so we'll call it the metric approach. So I will now give you an outline of these two approaches, and I'll illustrate some of the results for looking at two particular examples.
Right. No, not at all. Because I was looking at that nabla which you have defining the flux of. Isn't that defined through a metric? Because otherwise you could use the differential of the Hamiltonian. But how you combine it with the symplectic form?
You just do it exactly the same way as you would a classical in classical mechanics, where you don't have a metric.
That nabla is just a derivative, it's just a gradient of a scalar, so it's not referring to any connection.
So it is the differential applied to a scalar, but then it's a covector. I'll combine it with a, it's a one form. How do I combine it with another two form without having a metric which converts that form to a vector, a covector to a vector? That was my question. But anyway,
it's just a differential with respect to the coordinates that you're using.
It is a covector.
Covector, yes.
And you're combining with a two covector.
No, it's a two. No.
The symplectic form.
If you look at the formula, that omega is contravariant.
No, that's the point. The symplectic form is a two covector. If you put in this is
no,
up.
It's the inverse of the symplectic. It's a two vector.
It's a two vector.
Okay, I can
take it afterwards. Of course, I'll be going to that.
Right. So let me tell you what type of constraints that we'll be looking at. So we'll be looking at constraints that can be formulated in this following form. So in other words, constraints that can be defined in terms of some sort of subspace or a total state space. And in particular, the two types of constraints that we've been looking at are the constraints when you require, for instance, the conservation of an observable, so where you have this function here being given by demanding that this, that the expectation value of some operator corresponding to an observable will be zero for a constant. Or you could imagine wanting to constrain to a more algebraically defined submanifold of your state space. So for instance, what I have here is the projective Hilbert space for two entangled spin 1/2 particles. And the thing, you don't need to worry about all the details of this picture, but the thing to take away from it is the fact that the states that are disentangled form a subspace of the total state space that are given by this Q here. And all the entangled states lie on the rest of the state space. So you could ask the question, what kind of motion do I get if I have a state and I constrain it to remain on this subspace? So that's actually one example that we'll be looking at a bit later on. So the symplectic approach, the way we impose the constraints on our motion. So this is our modified equation of motion, where this is just Hamilton's equation, this first term. And the way we impose the constraints is really through introducing Lagrange multipliers and then coupling this to the symplectic gradient flow of the constraint function. And the cases that we've been looking at are those when you can find the Lagrange multipliers explicitly. So for a given set of constraints, what you would do is you would consider this relation, expand it using the chain rule, substitute your equation of motion into this expression here, which gives you this, and setting this to zero allows you to find the Lagrange multiplier through first defining this matrix here, which is basically this term here in the equation, which in the case when these correspond to observables, is just a commutator between your two observables. And in the cases where this is non-singular, you can take its inverse, and that gives you the Lagrange multiplier. We also noticed that substituting the expression for the Lagrange multiplier back into our original equation of motion, it's possible to rewrite it in this following form, where basically we have the same form of the equation as our original Hamilton's equation, but with a modified symplectic structure. And it turns out that this modified symplectic structure can be interpreted as the induced symplectic structure on the constraint surface that you're, where you're basically constraining your motion to. And this is given by this expression here, where again, this is the inverse of this matrix. So what kind of motion, what might one expect from this? Well, let's go back to this example here of having two spin 1/2 particles and wanted to constrain it to remain on the subspace. So as John was mentioning yesterday, the state space of a spin 1/2 particle can be visualized as the surface of the Bloch sphere. So this product space, this state of disentangled states can basically be visualized as the product space of two Bloch spheres, since the particles are disentangled. So if I have two spin 1/2 particles with this following Hamiltonian, and I initially put the system on this on the disentangled subspace, and I then constrain it to remain on that surface, what I would expect, what I find, is a quite nonlinear and quite intricate motion. So what this picture here shows you is really just a snapshot of the kind of vector field that you would expect on an example of what you might find. So basically, you can think of the motion as evolving the system as you've got coupled motion on these two Bloch spheres, and the evolution is moving around. And if I say, if I pick a state for my spin, for my second particle, and I say, what is the vector field induced on the first, on S1, the first two-sphere when the state is in, when the second particle is in this state, then I find this. Which might look a little bit confusing, but if you think of just unitary evolution of a single spin 1/2 particle, what that corresponds to is rigid rotation around an axis. So this is, as you can see, very, very far from describing any form of rigid rotation. So this is the kind of non-linearity. Sorry, I can't show you a more funky simulation of this, but it's quite hard to find what the actual motion is. So, but as I mentioned, there is a limit to what systems you can apply this extension of the classical method to. So the other way in which you could think of implementing your constraints is by just saying, okay, I have my state space. I have defined some sort of subspace in this state space that I want to constrain the evolution of my system to. That might correspond to some set of conserved observables or some other surface that you've chosen. And another way of constraining it to remain on the surface is just to take away all the orthogonal components of the vector field that would move the motion away from this, from the surface. So that's basically what we do here, where we use the fact that we can do this because we have a metric on our state space. So that's what gives this approach its name. So it's very similar to the previous method, only now we use the metric gradient flow coupled to a Lagrange multiplier instead. And it turns out that the condition that you need for solving, for finding the Lagrange multiplier is somewhat weaker. But if you apply this method to a system that you could also solve using the symplectic form, you can show that the two approaches give you the same, that they reduce to each other and they give you the same answer, which is something. So we go about finding the Lagrange multipliers here in a very similar way. We analyze again this relation, expand it using the chain rule, substituting our equation of motion, setting this to zero. We can find the Lagrange multipliers in the case when there exists an inverse to this relation here. And now since we have a metric here, what this expression corresponds to in the case when these constraints are given by conserved observables are the covariance between these two observables. Different here. So this is our Lagrange multiplier, and substituting that into the equation of motion, that gives us that. So something you might ask then is, can you formulate a general condition under which this equation of motion can be written in the same form as the symplectic approach can be written in terms of a modified symplectic structure on our constraint surface? And it turns out that this condition is given by this following relation here, where J is the complex structure on our space, on gamma, and where I've defined mu, to make the equation a bit neater, like this. So let's now go back and look at a simpler example where we just have one constraint. So this is an example of a system that you would not be able to look at using the classical extended approach, the symplectic approach. And that's when I have a single spin 1/2 particle, and I'm going to pick a really, really simple Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is just going to be given by sigma z. Now, if I were to just look at the unitary evolution of this unconstrained, that would just correspond to rigid rotation around the z-axis. So it would basically just move around like this. But I'm going to impose that an observable that does not commute with the Hamiltonian has to be conserved. So for the sake of argument, let's pick the sigma x spin matrix. So basically what happens is that instead of just having, as in the unconstrained case, two fixed points at both poles, we end up with two great circles of fixed points, these red lines here, where any particle, where any state that starts rather on one of these lines or circles remain there. And all other states evolve on these yellow integral curves around until they hit one of these circles of fixed points. So basically, we've managed to find a behavior where we partitioned our two-sphere into four parts that don't communicate with each other. So this is, of course, highly non-unitary. That's quite interesting. So this is, as I said, has all been applied to pure quantum states. Now, how could we extend this to also include mixed states? Well, in order to look at mixed states, the first thing we did was to go back and reformulate these two approaches on Hilbert space. And then for a mixed state, you have your state described by density matrix. And this would be your ordinary equation of motion, where H is now again your Hamiltonian operator, and this is your density matrix describing your state. And basically what we find is that it is possible to formulate these two approaches for mixed states, where basically the equation of motion is modified by introducing again our Lagrange multipliers and now coupled to the commutator between the constraints and the density matrix. Again, it is possible to find these Lagrange multipliers explicitly for several cases. And we do that again by, as same as before, we consider the time variation of the expectation value of this, which has to be zero, and that allows us to find the following form for the Lagrange multiplier, where this is the inverse of this matrix here, which is basically the expectation value of this commutator. Similarly, for the metric approach, instead of having a commutator here, we get an anticommutator. Again, we can solve for our Lagrange multipliers, provided that the inverse of this exists, where we now have the expectation value of this anticommutator. So to summarize, I hope I've given you a feeling for the fact that the phase-based description of quantum mechanics can be a powerful tool for addressing certain questions in quantum mechanics. And it is possible, using this formalism, to find two complementary frameworks in which you can treat quantum constraints. The first one, the symplectic approach, which is taking Dirac's method and applying it to quantum systems. And the second, which is a distinct approach without a classical counterpart, which is applicable to a somewhat larger class of constraints that you might want to consider. I've also shown you that we've derived a sufficient condition for ensuring when the two approaches are equivalent. And I've also very, very quickly shown you that it is possible to extend these methods to mixed quantum states by going back into Hilbert space. Something we'd like to do in the near future is finding an experimental setup where one could formulate a set of constraints using this framework to basically see how it could be useful. So if anyone can think of any constrained system that they would like to explore, then do come and talk to me. So if you'd like to find out more, this is some references, and thank you.
What happens when you don't have the equivalence between the two ways of imposing the constraints?
What happens when you don't have it?
Yes. Which one do you choose, or what are the two differences?
Well, you choose, put it this way, there are some systems that you can't treat with a symplectic approach.
Okay.
But there are no systems that you can treat with the symplectic approach that you could also not treat with the metric approach. The metric one is the more general of the two.
But when you can treat both, they always agree, or
for For the, as long as this condition is satisfied, they agree.
But when this condition is not satisfied, then you have assembly tube by two manners, which...
Yeah, so I mean, I haven't looked at it, I haven't found any example for which it's true.
What are the conditions?
So the condition is, it's basically this condition here, where this is the inverse of the covariance between the two. In the case where you have observables, this is the covariance, the inverse of the covariance between the two.
Okay, over here, then Raphael next. Could you go to one of the last equations that you put up for the mixed thing?
This one?
The one with the anti-conjugate. So yeah. That looks a lot like a master equation that I think it's the Lindblad form or something. Have you ever seen this?
Well, it has been pointed out to me. I mean, this is a very recent result, so I haven't really had time to
I think these sorts of equations are used quite often in experiments done in the NMR labs at the IQC.
Uh-huh.
They use this master equation.
Okay.
And so I guess the question would be, there you just impose, I think it's to do something to do with noise, that you impose these extra constraints.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me it's weird, because in classical we can easily see where the constraints are coming from, but I don't see what in quantum mechanics an intuitive picture what these constraints would be.
What they would be. Well, so I mean, what we've tried to do is not necessarily to look at any specific constraints, but to see if you can even build a framework whereby, if you can formulate your constraints as this set of functions, whether you can treat them at all and get something and learn something from them. And I mean, in the sense that you can obtain dynamical equations for the systems using this approach, I think that might turn out to be very useful. But I mean, it would be interesting to actually find a system that someone is interested in looking at, some sort of physical constraint.
So I was, you mentioned two different approaches, but there's a third approach that people, is the one that people use, which just involves doing this sort of naive quantum analog of the usual Dirac prescription. So for example, people working with quantum gravity, they're very concerned with this issue and in setting up a Schrodinger type treatment of QED or a gauge theory, you have the Gauss law constraint.
Mm-hmm.
But there you end up with a linear unitary evolution. So I'm confused about the relationship between this approach and that other approach. I mean, that approach doesn't refer at all to the CPN or the space of pure states or anything like that. But it's the standard approach that you see in a textbook if you read a textbook on QED. So is this totally orthogonal to that? I mean, what if you applied this to QED, for example?
The short answer is that I'm not sure what would happen if you applied it to QED. It's not something that I've looked at. It would be, of course, interesting to see how that would differ from what you call the standard approach to looking at constraints.
Or if you applied this standard approach when I'm talking to just a finite dimensional system, would it be something very different from this, or would there be some connection?
That's something that I haven't looked at now. I mean, so this, what I've looked at, is only for finite dimensional systems. I don't know.
It was mentioned over here that looks like a Lindblad equation. Mm-hmm. Well, as I understand it, you can't really get nonlinear evolution out of a Lindblad equation because it's just some overall CP map and you're just tracing out part of it. Mm-hmm. But in this case, can you get actual nonlinear evolution of the density matrix?
That, I mean, as I said, this is something that we've literally just brought translated the results back into density matrix language, if you want. So we haven't looked at that yet.
Yeah, that manifests. This is linear.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can't possibly get anything out of it. But the
it's not linear because rho is in lambda.
Yeah, that's right. So that's really interesting because, and this is going to go far afield when I say this, so don't get scared. But anybody. But I was looking at having some discussions about wormholes, and they seem to imply a constraint on the type of system that can go through. And you actually get something like this, where, well, I don't know if it's like this or not, but you get a constraint that leads to a nonlinear evolution.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting to look at it in this approach.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'd be interested to talk about you.
Cool. Let's see, Rob and then Chris.
So on your very last slide, you said you were interested in hearing about possible experimental setups that could realize these constraints.
Mm-hmm.
But given that the evolutions you're describing are nonlinear, so not only are they not unitary, but they don't correspond to a completely positive trace-preserving linear map, we know that they're not physical evolutions according to quantum theory. So it seems to me that the sorts of evolutions you're describing are possible candidates for alternatives to quantum theory. But I couldn't find any, if quantum theory is correct, I couldn't find any experimental setup that would realize those constraints.
Those particular...
If you have wormholes, it...
Sure, but what I really meant was...
But even for a subsystem, the evolution has to be completely positive, trace-preserving linear map, which this is not.
Okay, so okay, when you you're talking about when you have mixed states.
Yeah. So I'm saying the alternatives to there are evolutions beside unitary evolutions in quantum theory that are allowed that could take pure states to mixed states, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all linear.
Right.
So, I guess so. What do you have in mind? What's the perhaps the motivation for studying these? Is it alternatives to quantum theory?
So the motivation was the original motivation was just to see if you could find something interesting by applying Dirac's method for constraints to a quantum system and seeing what comes out and if something useful does come out. When I said that I'd like to find an experimental setup that realizes some specific constraints, I didn't necessarily mean the ones that I chose to look at in this presentation. That's constraints that we picked just because they were in some ways easy to work with or interesting mathematically to sort of see how you could constrain to general subspaces. I mean, what I really meant is I'd be interested to apply this framework to a constraint defined by someone who would like to look at a particular system that they're interested in and see what this kind of formalism would give you in that case, and if that's something that you can then verify. Then. Yeah.
Still, of course, Chris, do you?
Yeah, well, my question kind of tacks on to Rob's, just a slightly different flavor of the same question, but if you take one of your constrained evolutions and apply it to half of an entangled pair,
mm-hmm.
So you've got two systems and you apply one, like the evolution that you showed on the block sphere, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you went around the quadrants, then because it's nonlinear, that's going to create all kinds of troubles. So for instance, you know, inner products won't be preserved. So consequently, states that were less distinguishable can become more distinguishable. And generally, one would expect, I don't see anything in here that stops it, one would expect to find signaling phenomena by use of acting this kind of evolutional map of a state. Does that trouble you? Or is there some way of getting around that in this framework?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's not something that I've really thought of as such, but I'd be interested to talk more about that.
just a quick follow-up to the CP map thing. As I understand it, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but the fact that it has to be CP mapped is only true if the evolution does not depend on the input state. If you were to actually engineer an interaction that depends on the state that's going in, then you can get effectively nonlinear evolution. Just wanted to add that.
Yeah, I want to continue the question of Rafael. And now I'm a bit confused. You just say that this I missed the beginning. You just say that the thing you're describing is the one of the Iraq.
But that was one of the things I was discussing. So it's two. So basically,
so let's take the one which you call the symplectic one that you mentioned at the end of your sentence, the one of the Iraq. But the one of the Iraq, strictly speaking, is still a unitary system. So it seems to me that what you're doing is...
But for classical systems, right? I mean, it's Dirac's theory for classical systems.
Oh, because the notion of Dirac theory for quantum systems.
No. That's not what I meant at all. I mean, so it's taking Dirac's theory as he formulated it for looking at constraints in classical mechanics, which he formulated on the classical phase space, and basically replacing the classical phase space with the quantum phase space, and saying what happens.
Okay. Do I understand what you're doing right? If I'm saying that usually when we deal with constraint system, RT or QD, what we do is that we really, in some sense, impose strongly the constraints, and then we leave only on the constraint surface. But here, what you're proposing, it seems to me, is a way to leave outside the constraint surface.
Well, no, you constrain it to a constraint. You constrain the evolution to a constraint surface is what you're doing.
But the evolution,
there's two different ways.
If all the psi and the commutator are zero, then the new term you impose goes away, right?
So, for a commutator, yeah, so it does have some limitations. So one of them is that you have to be able to find the inverse of these matrices that I define as part of the...
The question is, once you're on the constraint surface, which is then you're in the Dirac, then is the evolution there, the residual evolution you get there, purely a unitary evolution?
Not in general, no.
Or even on the constraint.
But I think when you say on the constraint surface, you're thinking of the classical phase space, right? I presume.
Yes.
But she means something different.
Okay.
She means surface in CPN or something like that.
Yeah,
I had a suggestion for a problem that would be very interesting to apply this to, which, as far as I know, cannot be treated in quantum mechanics.
Okay.
So maybe it's not a physics problem. Anyway, it's an interesting for physics to think about. Which is the ball rolling without slipping on a plane.
Okay.
So this constraint involves the velocities, essentially, and so it's not... I'm not sure it quite fits into your scheme, but I was hoping you could easily adapt your scheme to handle it. As far as I know, there's no... I mean, because there's a problem with the action principle, classically. That's basically why there's trouble with quantum mechanics. As far as I know, there's nothing that anyone has claimed would be the quantum system, you know, the quantum version of a ball rolling without slipping.
Oh,
so this might give you a way to define what that would be.
Okay, yeah.
It sounds like it's experimentally reasonable, you know, I suppose. If Rob is right, it's not, but if wormholes are brought in, maybe it will.
That's the solution. All about the wormholes.
If I understand what you said, if you have a constraint, you do depend, like your evolution does depend on the initial.
It doesn't have to. It depends on the constraint. Mm-hmm. When you have an energy constraint, it depends on the state.
Okay, well, we've had a long and wide range of discussion, which I'm sure will continue. Did anybody have any further specific question they wanted to address right now? Well, let's thank you.